Why, hello there. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to a brand new season of Quantum Conversations, aka QC, and this is season two to be precise. It's been a minute or two. As some of you might already know, we like to cover a variety of topics on the show, a cornucopia, a smorgasbord, if you will. And as always, the aim of the podcast is to look at things from different angles and through different lenses. And whenever it lends itself, consider what might be overlooked, not taken into account, conveniently omitted, or intentionally redacted. My name is Nyusha, the show's host and creator. Paul, who co-hosted most of last season with me, has decided to reshift his focus back to his main passions, music and photography. I want to take this moment to thank him for creating QC's lovely theme music, as well as doing initially some of the sound editing work, and of course, his contributions as a co-host. I wish him all the best and much success in his upcoming projects. The conversational part of this podcast changes only slightly in that I'll be having guests from time to time, but as ever, it's the conversations that I have with you, dear listeners, and the ones I'm hoping you will carry on and have with others on any topics or themes which might intrigue you. So, without any further ado, let's jump right in with today's topic on mythological figures and ancient symbols, and how these are so commonplace on company logos, as well as national and international organizations. Yet, strangely, there is also a massive disconnect here. For instance, what does it say about us as a society when we instantly recognize the Nike swoosh, yet far fewer of us actually know what the ancient mythology behind the company name is and what that swoosh is supposed to actually symbolize? Why or how have mythological figures and symbols, as well as their underlying meanings, become so eroded? There's a lot to rediscover here, and it might just require more than one episode to cover the meanings and messages of even just a handful of these symbols and mythological figures. With that, I am really delighted that I can dive into this topic with a guest. And joining me is my longtime friend Shannon, an artist, the co-creator of the QC logo, and an all-round creative person who happens to share my fascination and interest in this particular arena. Hello, Shannon.
Hello, Nyusha. Thank you for having me here.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I know that, like me, mythology and symbolism are things that you have a particular penchant for. It's an area that you've, I think, researched quite a bit.
Indeed. It's a wrap. Yes.
So you are the ideal person for this topic today.
Thank you very much. Again, happy to be here and chat about something I love.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, a fair warning, we will probably go down a few tangents. We'll try to circle it back, reel back in. But it's, as I think we'll quickly come to realize, it's very easy to go on those detours.
Absolutely. There's a lot to go through.
Definitely. So before we get the ball rolling, what actually got you into mythology? Was there like a specific catalyst that led you down that proverbial garden path, or was there a sort of like more like a series of things?
Well, I think looking back, I think it probably stemmed from a book that I had as a child on the Greek myths that was given to me. And I think that was probably one of my favorite books. So it was obviously had pictures in it, which helped. But obviously it was written for a child. But yeah, I was absolutely fascinated. So I think that was my kind of first conscious memory of the goddesses, the gods. Maybe a little bit about how horrible the world can be as well.
Okay.
Because as you know, the Greek myths are, they can be quite violent and nasty. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I was riveted from there on. And then that just continued throughout my life. Alchemy, myths, legends, you name it. stories, anything kind of mystical, esoteric, the occult, all that, deep dives my whole life.
Yeah.
Rabbit holes.
Yeah.
Found.
Yeah. And it's really easy to do too. Once you start, you know, then you go, ooh, and it's like, it is sort of very like peeling. Well, I don't even know whether it's peeling back layers because it just seems like you get more layers. But it is, I think it can be very like, ooh, and that's connected to that. And this is interesting. So yeah.
For sure.
And I definitely agree with you. Like, I think when I sort of first got my introduction to the Greek mythology and I was probably like 8 or 9. I was both really fascinated and also really horrified. And there were things that I'm sure at that age you don't grasp, especially in regards to anything sort of allegorical, metaphorical, or even symbolic, because I think like most kids, when they first encounter this, you kind of take it at face value. So when you're reading the beginnings of the Olympic pantheon, you actually have the precursor to that, which is about the Titans. And so you learn about Zeus's origins and then you go, God, this is really grotesque. I mean, it's fascinating, but grotesque.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely a calling for the macabre and the, you know, the kind of, well, it was exciting, wasn't it? It was exciting.
Yeah.
And the war, I think, you know, as a young child, I had no personal firsthand experience of anything bad because obviously, you know, your parents shelter you. Mm. You don't watch the news. You haven't seen 12 rated movies.
Right.
You know, so yeah, no, it is. It was a huge eye opener for me.
Yeah.
Like you. I mean, it was just like astronomical. You just like evil exists.
Yes. I think that's it. You do get your first. I mean, I think I was aware of things just not being right in the world, but this just was also from such a bizarre angle, you know, because you do literally have, you know, infanticide, patricide. These are sort of questions I think a child would very straightforwardly and innocently ask. And the adult answer is to shelter you. Go, oh, no, but it's not real. And it's fine. It may not be real.
But they are. I mean, all of it is kind of, you know, based in reality. It's the hero's journey, you know.
Right.
No, ultimately, you know, mothers kill their children, fathers kill their children.
It's very bizarre, but very, very fascinating as well, because you see these people, well, these mythological figures, many of them deities and gods and goddesses, and they do very at least, you know, in your child's mind about what a god is supposed to be.
Well, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, but for me, a god was always supposed to be benefic, above doing terrible things. So when you see a kind of super being that has powers and that does horrible things, or you go, what is wrong with these people? And then you go, oh yeah, because they are a reflection of in some ways, of society at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully it sunk in that they were malefic non-humans. These were the gods. And unlike you, I really had no concept of even God at all at that point until much later.
Yeah. Also probably because, you know, at that age, that was the first like things that you wouldn't have been able to read about otherwise. Not at school, probably not from our parents. They would not have been like, oh yeah, go ahead and read about monsters and demons.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I found it difficult finding books as a young female child that I actually, because my mom took me to the library every week. Mm-hmm. And yet I would be like, I don't want to read another Judy Blum. Thank you very much. Do I have to read Little Women? Do I have to? Like, that just sounds so, it just, yeah, I was far too, well, definitely thrown into more exciting, adventurous, mythological things for sure. You know, and a lot of science fiction wasn't even appropriate, but I did go down that path.
I was lucky in the sense that, like, you know, my mum didn't prevent me from reading certain things. She always tried to get me to read that things that were a little bit more age appropriate. But I mean, I was exposed to like some of the older Grimm fairy tales in German. Right. So not the sanitized versions that you get. And so those were also equally, yeah, they're very dark and very gothic. And we say fairy tales, but some of them are more nightmarish, you know.
Well, fairies, you know, one of those words that can be malefic and sweet and
benefic.
Kind.
Benefic, yeah.
No, a fairy can be, you need to stay away from fairies.
But they can't, you know, it just depends. They can be good or they can be bad for you. So,
just like humans, you know.
Exactly. So on this path of mythology, I thought what better place to start with one of the most, let's say, ubiquitous, recognizable business icon / logos, which is, you know it, I know it, Starbucks. So, you know, I thought, well, first before we even go there, we should probably try and figure out where Starbucks got its name from and why they chose the imagery of the two-tailed mermaid, which I think they refer to actually as a siren.
Yeah.
Why they chose that and sort of look into a little bit about that iconography and the story about it, and also some of the slightly quixotic decisions for that. So yeah, let's get into that. So Starbucks, for anybody who doesn't know, it's like the fast food equivalent of the coffee world, right?
Yep.
And it's an interesting choice of names because supposedly, according to the lore, the CEO of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, said the name came from a character in Moby Dick, in the book Moby Dick, whose name was not in the plural, Starbuck, rather than Starbucks. But I guess that's also clever marketing. Right, it's not just one. There's many.
Well, because they were, wasn't it two friends that lived by the ocean? They had a connection to the ocean, didn't they?
Sure. Yeah.
They brainstormed down that road of we want something that reflects the ocean, and so I guess they knew fishermen and all sorts of things related to being near the coast.
Yeah, in Seattle. I mean, they were their hometown was Seattle. And, you know, their first coffee place was like in the early 70s. I want to say something like 71, 72, 73. So, you know, this was before it became like this massive franchise. But I just thought it was interesting that they went from a singular Starbucks, because they just could have said Starbucks to Starbucks, plural. So that's, you know, I think clever marketing there. And then they decided to choose not just any mermaid / siren, but a two-tailed mermaid. And then that's where things get a bit more interesting.
Sure. And I think if you recall that the Starbucks logo has shape-shifted its way through the decades, hasn't it? So it started out as something completely different to what it is now.
Yes.
So and the two-tailed mermaid was very, very much prominent.
Yes. Yes. So this two-tailed mermaid, which is also known by another name, the Melusine, and it's quite seductive. And that was the idea too, to have this two-tailed mermaid. We'll give a quick descriptor, shall we?
Yes, it's a very sexual image. The first wood engraving, I guess, from a 14th century picture that they found. They definitely, you know, sex sells, so they definitely wanted something sexy, something that stood out, and it definitely did.
Yeah, so the idea was, the original founder's idea was that they wanted to have something that was, and I quote, as seductive as the coffee itself. So that was the pitch, right? And when we think of when we look at the image of the Melusine, the original images of the Melusine, it's really quite naughty. But yeah, it's interesting because, again, in the original Starbucks logo, she's basically bare-breasted. And, you know, I don't think it's a big deal, but it would be considered, you know, a bit risque. And nowadays, instead, what you have with the logo is really just her face.
Yeah, right? It absolutely evolved into something that's almost unrecognizable. I mean, if you take a cursory glance, you wouldn't even think about her being some kind of sea creature at all. You just, you know, her tails are barely there now.
Yeah, I mean, you can glean from it. You can glean these scales just sort of vaguely. But certainly, I guess, and I'm sure this is also probably in part in response to them becoming so global and maybe serving their coffee in places where that the fact that she was bare-breasted originally, right? And that was removed, you know. First, I think it was covered, then it was removed entirely. So all you see are the little bits of scales that are kind of coronating her, you know, sort of in some ways. Because I think if you see the original one, which was in the early 70s, you'd be quite shocked. Also, it was not green. The original was brown. It was brown and beige, I think. Coffee colors. Yeah. And so that leads us to the fact that what this dual-tailed sirens mermaid is in most cases would be the Melusine, even though the CEO or the founders said that they were inspired by a wood in carving from a Viking ship, which is a bit interesting. And that's not to say that the dual-tailed siren didn't exist certainly in other cultures and goes far back, but the Melusine is more of a medieval icon.
I was actually thinking how somehow they came up with, or they found this engraving, and I know I'm going off on a tangent here, you know, before the internet. Before there were resources at the touch of a button. It's just interesting. It would be interesting to find out how exactly they found that wood engraving. You know, maybe they just came across it and they just liked it. And like you say, it was very seductive and that's what they went for. I can't think of the word of the women that are usually on the front of the boats.
And it is often a mermaid, isn't it? Yeah, the name fails me as well, but it will probably come to me after we've recorded this.
Yeah, which is, you know, always the way. Where's our fact checker?
You're speaking to her.
Yeah. Anyway, Melusina, such a tragic tale, as you can probably imagine from what we've already been talking about. It kind of doesn't end well, people. Bless her heart. So she was the daughter of a human father and a fairy mother. Her mother was called Précine. And Précine, her mother, bless her heart, cursed her daughter when she disobeyed her father. And apologies, audience, I can't remember what the father was called. But anyway, so Melusine was cursed from that day forward for disobeying her father. And this curse entailed turning into a half hybrid shape-shifting sea serpent stroke mermaid stroke siren, whatever you want to call her. You know, we're not quite sure what type of hybrid creature she was. And again, the historical record of images of Melusine differ too along the decades and centuries. And behold, so Melusine did actually fall in love, deeply, deeply in love, and her husband were very happy together, and they had 10 sons.
Well, very active.
So anyway, they were very much in love for a very long time, King Raymondin, her husband, was always fine with the kind of strict adherence to one just little promise that he made when they got married. And that was that every Saturday she was to be left alone. He was not to see her. It was her own private day. Obviously, she didn't tell him why, because, of course, this day was the day that she transformed. And he was completely fine for a long, long time until I think his cousin said, "This is a little bit fishy, Nusha."
Interesting choice of words.
Right? And said, "Do you think she's having an affair? Do you think, you know, what is she doing?" And then, of course, you know, Raymondin was like, "Oh, yeah, you're right." So sadly, Raymondin spied on his wife and...
The one thing he was promised not to do.
Yes, the ultimatum and the promise was broken that day. And he clapped his eyes on her. And, you know, as you can imagine, quite horrified and felt a little bit betrayed. But he kind of was okay with it. But I don't think things were ever the same after that. Now, I just want to point out that there's a plethora of different tellings of this story throughout the centuries. Just like any comparable mythology, you know, there are lots of different countries in Europe that told it a different way, and then it was written down in different ways and things like that. So there are a lot of different endings and different ways of telling this. But yeah, medieval literature was kind of, you were lucky if you could read and write, basically, at that point. So ultimately, in the end, I think the catalyst for the demise of the marriage was that one of their sons was killed in battle. But I think it was the son was to blame because he was quite the monstrous warrior. Mm. And the Raymondin, the husband, blamed Melusina for this, you know, creating such a hybrid half-human thing. And I think that was somehow that cursed her forever. And mm-hmm. so she couldn't shapeshift any longer. Mm-hmm. She turned immediately into the creature that she would turn into on a Saturday. And, you know, in one story, in one telling, she actually turns into a dragon and flies away.
Right. That's the version that I know.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's a little bit of a tragic ending. But yes, often things are tragic.
Yeah. So it's also, I was just going to add, not to interrupt your flow too much, but I think the father, Melusine's father, is known as Alinas, and he's the king of Albany or Albas, and there's also a connection to Avalon and the Arthurian legend, because when Pressine and her three daughters, including Melusine, are cast out, they go to the Lost Isle of Avalon, which is where the Melusine and her mother and then her two sisters grow up.
That's another telling. That's actually another telling. I just tried to stick with one.
Right.
And there are also links to royal bloodlines who proclaim that they are descendants of, you know, the Lusignan family, and claim that they are related to these hybrid fairy serpentine sirens.
So I think there are quite a few noble families and aristocratic families from places like Luxembourg, Germany, Netherlands, and obviously France, and then I think Wales and England, where they all claim their bloodline directly stems from the Melusine. So that's quite fascinating. And like you said, there are variations, and I think that's going to be true for all mythologies, because these are just retellings of the same story or the same concepts. And these were obviously oral traditions before they were written down. But the one that I'm most familiar with is from a French poet and author, Jean Darras. So that's DARRAS. And again, we're looking at, I think he wrote this down somewhere in the Middle Ages, around the late 1300s.
Yep.
So I know in that particular variation, the Melusine, everything that you were mentioning up until then is very, very similar. I think the difference is that when Raymondin,
Raymondin,
yes, thank you. So Raymondin discovers his wife's secret and that she's this two-tailed mermaid. And sometimes she's described as having two serpents' tails, and they're even winged. So this sort of has more of a connection to a dragon, which you were mentioning earlier. And he decides to keep this a secret until his two oldest sons, one brother, murders the other. And you may be right, it might be in battle or in some kind of a feud. And at that point, Raymondin is so grief-stricken that he blames his wife for such a heinous act. And
it's the catalyst that triggers him to just not be okay with it.
Right. And he calls his wife a serpent demon. And at that moment, when he proclaims her to be this serpent demon, she assumes the form of either a serpent or a dragon and then flies away. But apparently, she comes back, and she comes back at night because she still has these two infant sons whom she nurses, which is really bizarre, though, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, ultimately, this is a multicultural telling. Every culture has not a story exactly like Melusina, but there's stories of the spirits of the fresh waters, these shape-shifting hybrid type creatures, you know, are just prolific throughout human mythology. And this one is just one of those stories. It's fascinating because there are so many retellings and different tellings, but I love how it's connected to real people in the now, the here and now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love how it connects to, you know, certain bloodlines and things like that. But yeah, it's a phenomenal story, and it's so wonderful to see that there are so many medieval woodcuts and illustrations that depict her. Yeah, it's great. So whether or not it's a good thing that Starbucks took her on we'll just never know, will we?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think one thing that stands out is that, and as you sort of just touched upon previously, is that the Melusine is actually tied with fresh water. So she's tied with wells, but also rivers, ponds, lakes, you know. There's a freshwater dual-tailed, let's say, mermaid or dual-tailed serpent figure or dragoness, and yet Starbucks, which is coastal by the sea, chose this. You know, so you can see that they didn't really do their research. You know, that's just sort of
they didn't know. They were two young guys who just thought, yeah, well, that'll do. She looks hot.
Yeah, exactly. That's saucy. Let's do that.
Saucy.
And again, I don't think these are things that the founders of Starbucks would have known or even bothered to research. But the story, with the story of the Melusine, it's a very ancient legend, and I think there's a component of this obviously that's quite saucy. And in order for this to have made it into the books, in written form during the Middle Ages, there also had to have been a morality tale to it, right? So there's this idea of doing things that are morally right, and there's certainly this idea of decency and indecency, and that's why Melusine's husband can't ever look on her upon a Saturday, and not just because she's shape-shifting, but also because she's bathing. And I think you've mentioned before we recorded that there were accounts where she was even giving birth on a Saturday, and how she managed to exact that timing is very, very impressive indeed.
ultimately she doesn't have superpowers. You know, this is a curse. She can't help it. It's, you know, it's not like she can click her fingers. She's not kind of a generic hybrid human god type thing, in that she can't control what's happening to her body and the transformation that happens, you know, she's cursed.
In that regard, for sure. But she, yeah. I do think she has superpowers because, you know, she is able to, when they are married, later on, you know, following this account of stories, she can bring incredible fortune or misfortune, right? So she has this capacity. And the idea of the Melusine, it's somebody who can be both very benefic or malefic, depending. And that's why there were these notions of not disturbing the wells, not disturbing the waters in that sense.
Yeah.
And another thing about the Melusine that is, I think, quite interesting is that despite her being this rather seductive but potentially scary figure, is that depictions of her are prevalent and can be found on buildings, especially medieval ones, throughout Europe, including churches. And there's one I saw a couple of years ago by the entry of a medieval church called St. Joseph's, I believe, in Goslar, Germany. And although it's small, it's still pretty striking, especially when you consider this rather pagan figure in an overtly sexual pose. I mean, it's really quite cheeky and quite naughty for that to be so visible on a wall.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I've seen similar things here where I live too. I mean, and dragons are prolific. And, you know, just like the stories, like you were saying, you have the naiads and the hydriads and all the freshwater spirits, you know, you need to watch your P's and Q's.
Yeah.
Treat her with respect or you're going to drown.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was going to say, there are variants of, or like predecessors to the Melusine, and not just the single-tailed mermaid, but the fact that you can find in Greco-Roman culture images of a dual-tailed mermaid, and these are sea or salt water related mythical beings.
Yeah.
So yeah, but it's very interesting because we, in a way, this is a very well-known mythology, but at the same time, I feel like a very forgotten mythology. And yet it's so ubiquitous if you look at the Starbucks logo.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, you know, every culture on the planet has, you know, female sea serpents, male sea serpents. In fact, Oannes, there's over 130 stories about this figure, Oannes, mm-hmm. under different names, but who walked out with his two fishtails, mm-hmm. walked out of the ocean and taught our ancient ancestors how to read, write, gave them technology. And it's just so fascinating to me, this comparable legend telling of, and it's the same dude, man. It's the same guy. And I mean, he had a female consort. I mean, I don't know. I actually don't know what her name was, but they just walked out of the ocean and taught us how to be civilized.
Right. It's interesting because that is, again, we seem to see so many similarities across cultures and across the ages. And even though, like you said, there are variants of the story, but there are certain characteristics that seem to come up again and again and again. And I think that's the fascinating part of our collective consciousness, maybe, or collective history. It's really embedded in our being. And we have somehow conveniently, I don't think we've, I mean, when I say we've conveniently forgotten, I think it's been conveniently forgotten out of us. But do you know what I mean?
Even though through schooling and our education in terms of our evolution, you know, and the standard model story of evolution is that we did come out of the water.
Yes, sure. And there's something to it there as well.
Yeah our roots are in the ocean.
And the other thing I wanted to sort of touch upon, and again, the sort of slight misnomer, it's when I say slight, because nowadays when you say siren, you do think mermaid. But if we look traditionally, at least from the old Greek mythology, a siren was not a mermaid.
No. Right?
And that story is slightly different. At some point, I think probably starting maybe in the you know, Middle Ages, there seemed to have been a retelling. The sirens of the Greek mythology suddenly turned strictly into the mermaids that we think about. Right. But the original mermaids of the Greek mythology were these women who were described as most of the time beautiful women up to about their torso, and the rest of them were birds, right? They were bird bodies from the bottom, and they had wings, and they were sirens because obviously they could sing so beautifully and lure sailors to the island where they were cursed and probably trying to get out of. And these men were lured and dashed upon the rocks into their deaths. But again, yeah, that's such a simplistic way of telling this mythology, because nobody ever seems to ask, well, why were they there in the first place?
Maybe they lost their beautiful bone shell combs.
Maybe. Maybe. Or in some older, and I guess this is some of the sort of fragments that they have been able to find, that these women were cursed there as possibly priestesses who were maybe devotees to one of the Greek goddesses and ended up being banished and cursed into these half bird creatures. And because they didn't have their voice, the only thing they could do was sing. They were probably trying to get these guys to help them off the island to, you know, relieve them of their curse. Although the one thing that has always sort of intrigued me was, like, if they're half birds, why didn't they just fly away?
Yeah. Well, you know, they didn't think it through, did they, Nish?
Either that, or they probably just had useless wings, you know, a bit like ostriches.
Who knows? You know, and ultimately, all these cursed women.
Yeah.
You know, it's very sad, but again, it's a theme. It's definitely a theme that runs through our cultural stories, for sure.
Yeah, and the theme also, you know, again, if we circle it back to the logo in Starbucks, is that they're all in some ways cursed, tragic, sure, you know, but also seductive. And so
they
have to be. But I definitely encourage anybody who is curious, and again, the links will be included in the description, but to really look into some of the history about, you know, mermaids and the Melusine and the idea about the sirens. Yeah, and this whole idea of shape-shifting and the very veritable layers, so that next time, you know, you come across the Starbucks logo, you go, you have a completely different interaction with it.
Yeah, and there's no apostrophe in there, people.
No apostrophe. Yeah.
I wonder if Starbucks would have become what they are today if they'd have been called Melusines.
I'll have a cup of Melusine.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Or like Siren Coffee. You know, that might have worked.
Sirens, that would have been good.
Sirens would have been great. Siren Coffee.
Just saying, Starbucks.
Yeah. Just saying. Indeed. So as we drift from one mythological figure to another, I'm going to carry us over to another super, super ubiquitous company in terms of their logos, instantly recognizable in this particular arena would be athletic wear. And that would be the Nike, or rather the Nike swoosh trademark, TM. TM. Yeah.
Not transcendental meditation, by the way.
Not transcendental. That would be great, though, wouldn't it? You have Nike, TM, transcendental meditation. So here's another one where everybody recognizes said swoosh, but very few people actually make a connection to A, the name Nike or Nike or Nike. What do you say for the word?
Well, you know what? I think because of the context, if I'm talking about the goddess, I'm going to say Nike. Mm-hmm. But if I'm talking about someone's shirt, I'm going to go, oh, that's a nice Nike shirt.
Right. Yeah, I'm probably the same. I probably say like Nikes for your trainers. And I'm like you, if I'm talking about the goddess, it's Nike or Nike, which would be more correct. Right. So we've given ourselves away, Shannon. in that that's exactly what it is. So again, this is where Philip Knight, he's the founder of the company, was looking for a logo design. And he went to a young university student back in the early 70s. And he gave the students a brief, which was really very little to go on, which was that I want a logo that has something to do with movement. So Carolyn Davidson came up with several designs, and one of it was the swoosh that we are all that we are all very, very familiar with. But that this said swoosh is a stylized interpretation of the Greek goddess Nike. And she is the goddess of, Shannon?
Victory.
Yes.
Challenges. Struggle.
Yeah, so indeed, she is the goddess of victory and movement and speed and triumph. As a goddess, she doesn't have a huge... She doesn't have a huge amount of like different responsibilities or areas. She's a little bit more confined, I would say.
Sure.
No? Yeah.
Which is maybe why she's not like a super popular goddess.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But she certainly, images of her have been quite prolific.
Yeah, back in the day. I meant like now. She's not a super popular goddess right now, people.
She's not a head honcho of the goddess. Well, she is. I mean, she is the goddess of victory, both for wars and peacetime, which I think is important to kind of highlight.
Yeah.
So obviously, there's an affiliation for her to be sort of choosing the victor in like competitive sports, Olympics, but also in war. And she is a winged goddess, which is also important because again, we were talking earlier about sort of iterations and variations of certain physical attributes of deities and mythological figure. And here's yet another one where we see sort of wing, and of course there's winged gods, but in this case we're focusing on winged goddesses, and Nike or Nike is certainly one of them. And she's depicted in various ways. Sometimes she's like carrying an amphora for libations. Sometimes she's carrying like a lyre.
Yeah.
But she's usually always winged, except for when she's reinterpreted as an Athena attribute or a personification of the goddess Athena.
Yeah. And Nike's sacred objects would differentiate her from Athena because they were quite similar. But I mean, this is a common, you know, thread and narrative throughout these characters. They were assigned different sacred objects to differentiate them, but then they could morph into, you know, cross culturally and over the centuries that went by, you know, these gods and goddesses would be named differently for instance, you know, the Greek and Roman pantheons.
Right.
You know, we have the same gods and goddesses, but they have different names. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, artistic license. Again, the stories changed. And I think a big part of this is that most people couldn't read and write. So these stories were told within households and within communities, you know, in the oral tradition and passed on. So again, Nike kind of fell by the wayside, didn't she, really?
Yeah, I think probably, you know, we can look to sort of the onset and spreading of Christianity, and where a lot of gods fell by the wayside. But I think if you weren't like such a prevalent god like Zeus or, you know, Hera or Athena, these other sort of secondary, for lack of a better term, gods and goddesses or figures would have become forgotten.
Absolutely. So she, Nike, was the divine charioteer for Zeus.
Indeed.
So she had a big responsibility, and she was obviously in Zeus's good books, and that's a great place to be.
if you know anything about Zeus.
Yeah. Hey, Zeus. So absolutely. And soldiers, before they went into battle, would sacrifice, would pray to her. They wanted Nike on their side when they went into battle. And she was an important manifestation. She was a, you could call her an egregore, in that she needed to be summoned.
Yeah, because she often determined who the victors would be.
Yeah.
Right? These are the people that are going to be glorious either in battle or in a competition.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like gladiator style.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because Nike's Roman name is in fact Victoria.
Yeah.
So again, very ubiquitous brand name with the swoosh symbol, and like very few people twig on to the sort of interesting mythological history behind it. And I can't speak for Carolyn Davidson who came up with the design, but I don't think there was huge amount of thought with the founder going into the mythology. Do you?
I don't know. I mean, I would love to know how he, you know, had stumbled across Nike. Was he American?
Yeah, Philip Knight is American.
Okay.
And from what I can understand from the information, he didn't ask for anything mythological. He just asked the university students that were commissioned to come up with a logo, to come up with something that created movement.
So he didn't have the idea of Nike?
I don't know. This is not clear. And I will have to go.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. So it is possible that the logo came and then somebody said, oh, well, what's that? Oh, that's like I was inspired by Nike. And he might have gone, hey, that's a great name for a apparel brand.
That's interesting. Sorry, folks. We don't know.
Yeah, we can definitely correct us if you are in the history about how the name came up. But
you know who to email.
Please be kind. I'm happy to make those corrections. But this is the information. I mean, the information that I know. It's also for me. It's always kind of interesting that you had this sports brand that was predominantly selling athletic wear and sports shoes, predominantly. At that time, mostly geared to men, young men, before it became sort of more popular amongst men and women, and that they would choose, again, this female figure.
Sure. Well, maybe it's akin to the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows? I mean, it is a shame that he didn't use it as a marketing tool, actually, because, you know, she was ultimately a mediator between the gods and the humans. You know, she would speak for the humans, and she would almost be like this advocate for humans in many cases, where she would go, oh, you know, please, you know, give him a break.
Yeah, spare him.
Spare him. She was powerful, you know, and ultimately with her golden sandals, people. You'd have thought that Nike would have pushed her into the realm of the sports kind of paraphernalia in the clothing line. I don't know. I just think I think he missed a trick, Nusha.
Yeah, I think he did too. But again, I often feel like there wasn't a lot of thought put in there beyond the, how can we use this as a marketing shtick? And, you know, will it appeal? And will it look good in our designs? And yet somewhere again in the collective psyche, we see these images of these mythological and, you know, sort of gods and goddesses and go, oh, yeah. There's always that. I always feel like there's that component. And it's also, I think, worth mentioning that even though Nike or Nike as a goddess wasn't like a major, major goddess, there are certainly, just in terms of winged goddesses, her predecessors or even her contemporaries in sort of the ancient world were vast. So it's Nike as a winged goddess didn't come out of nowhere.
We can
certainly look at, you know, figures like, even though I think they were much denser, much more important figures, but we can look to figures like Inanna and Ishtar.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, and they were huge in their day, people.
Yeah. So, I mean, if anybody doesn't know, Inanna is like the top goddess of Mesopotamia.
She is. And she was the first.
Babylonia.
Yeah. She was the first, you know, she's in the first written record of this civilization. The tablets, the Sumerian, you know, the Mesopotamian tablets, they log the sheep that were sacrificed to Inanna. I mean, I know it's quite repetitive and boring, but those tablets tell us so much in terms of the worship of Inanna. And then for the Hindu, for the ancient Indians, you had the Kali figure. And even though she wasn't winged, she was, her characteristics were about the paradoxical coincidences of war and peace.
And with Inanna and her iteration as Ishtar for the Assyrians and the Egyptians, she's the goddess of love, war, and fertility. And she's invoked for political power. So obviously there are going to be various iterations of her, but she's predominantly depicted as a winged goddess. There are also depictions of her where she's seen with having her foot on top of a lion. It's like, you know, she's conquering the beast. And she's connected with the planet Venus. Her abode is all of heaven.
If you look at depictions of Isis or Inanna, there are so many Mesopotamian ancient gods and goddesses who were winged. Sometimes they look like they're even in craft. I know we're not going down that rabbit hole, but Ahura Mazda.
Yes.
Enki and Enlil, they often look like they're like flying around in something. So the ancient depictions and stone relief carvings are fascinating. It's a fascinating rabbit hole.
It is. And Nut, the goddess, the Egyptian goddess Nut, very often she's depicted either as having like vulture wings on her headdress, or she's actually, and this is interesting, it's not just that she is so much winged as she's got like this winged kind of cape that allows her to fly.
Right.
So yeah, it's, I think it's definitely worth looking into because again, you know, we see this repeated pattern of this mythological deity. And in figures like Inanna, Ishtar, Nut, they have, unlike Nike or Nike, where, you know, she's reduced to like this sort of one particular realm, Inanna and Ishtar are extremely dense. I think throughout the different dynasties and throughout the different centuries, more was tacked on.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess their attributes were so important and their stories, again, passed through cultures, you know, war, peace. These things were passed on and they just transformed and morphed into different characters with the right semantics and the right name. Because they were so important. They were so super important. And the fact that we had the rise of Christianity, for better or for worse, kind of obliterated the presence of the divine feminine ultimately. And it is a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that, you know, in at least in Christianity, a lot of those ideas within these various female deities became sort of reconfigured into Mary, the mother of God. And it's also really important to remember that Inanna or Ishtar is very much a key figure in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I don't think a lot of people realize is sort of the very first big epic.
First story people.
Yeah.
And but there are crossovers between, you know, the Mary, Jesus, and Christos story. I mean, we're not deep diving into Gnosticism, but
not yet.
not this episode. But Isis gave birth, you know, as a virgin. You know, this crossover, and there's plenty of books out there if you're interested. You know, in terms of Nike, she's wonderful, and it's great that even if people don't know that they're summoning, with their casting of spells, every time they say that word, you know, maybe she kind of bats her eyelids and says, oh, thank you. There's a nod to her, even if people don't know it.
Yeah. Yeah. Another mythological figure that I was thinking about really in terms of sort of being more corollary to Nike would be the Valkyrie. I mean, although there are multiple Valkyrie rather than just being one goddess like Nike, they are sometimes referred to as being divine, even though they have a lot of mortal characteristics. Sometimes they are seen in a more benefic light and sometimes in a more demonic light. And they're the chooser of, well, as the Norse name, Old Norse name would seem to indicate, they are the chooser of the slain or the fallen. And and eventually they also have, you know, more nuance to them. And later on, you do see the Valkyrie being referred to as sometimes as the Oskme, which means wish maiden. And that's because men, especially men heading off to battle, would pray to them and pray to them to become victorious.
Sure. No, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, war was kind of part and parcel of everyday life, just like it is now. And, you know, back then they were a little bit more spiritually minded. And these huge things in life had to be attributed to a divine factor.
Yeah.
And the polarized nature of it, especially, you know, when you look at the polarized concept of war and peace, is just such a massive topic.
Yeah. Again, another rabbit warren that we could go down.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. But interesting that, again, that's another culture that we can tick the box where we have this attribute of they're like the fates, aren't they?
Yeah. So, you know, with the Norse tales, it's interesting in the fact that we're seeing this evolution of these figures, right? Initially, they were just sent by Odin to determine who would be the victors in battle, very similar to Nike. And they would take the slain, the glorious chosen few, to go down to Valhalla to wait for the end of times, you know, for the epic battle. The Valkyrie, eventually, as they began to form different persona and different characters, would make their own decisions. And they would just say things like, oh, actually, I don't want this person to win. He's not a good guy, Odin. And, you know, they would just completely disobey him. And very often they would fall in love. And more than often, these were mortals. And, you know, they would get married and they would have kids. And oddly, specifically, in many cases, they would, you know, only be together with their mortal spouses for like 7 winters. And then, you know, they would just fly off somewhere, never to be seen again, leaving the men to search for them in vain for the rest of their lives. But what's interesting here, again, is this idea that these Valkyrie were often depicted as either being able to fly or, you know, having indeed wings. Or they were winged and flew on horses.
Yeah.
It seems a bit excessive, but all right.
No, absolutely.
But yeah, they were there to carry souls and bring them to Valhalla, bring them to the underworld, and also again making a decision about who's the victor. And that then sort of kind of circles back to your reference of Kali.
Mm. Well, I mean, talk about responsibility.
I know.
You know, the fact that the outcomes of war were in the laps of these goddesses is quite extraordinary. And Kali, again, is a huge goddess worthy of a podcast all of her own. She ultimately is the great destroyer and the great creator. So yes. Things must be destroyed to be recreated. It's like the breath in and the breath out. The breath in and breath out. She breathes in the universe and the cosmos, and then she breathes it out, and she has to obliterate everything
in order to start again.
So she's that ultimate polarization of, you know, like things like war, you know. You're a winner or you're a loser. And Kali is quite, you know, even though most depictions of her are quite horrific, the bloody tongue and the severed heads, but ultimately, you know, she's about helping us to get rid of our egos. And that's what the severed heads usually depicts, in that she's, you know, helping us to, you know, get rid of, shed that egoic earth sack and be more divine people.
And again, she's a very, like, I think with all, with you know, even when you're looking at sort of the Inanna Ishtar figure, she's very complex. And again, also over the course of the centuries has different attributes. And,
well, luckily with the Hindu culture, they have their ancient writings and they still use the same language. So it's unique in that they haven't lost a lot along the way, and they still use the same texts, the ancient texts. They still use the same ones. And of course there's retellings, but ultimately the Hindu pantheon of gods and goddesses is quite intact, which is phenomenal and amazing.
Yes, it is. But you will also see regional differences, and you will see like their consorts not being always the same. Some of their attributes are different depending on where they are worshipped. So that's what I'm talking about. Even sometimes the imagery is slightly different. So
because she is polarized. So the image we usually see of Kali is horrific. But ultimately, if you read about her, she has a completely different side to her. And that's not usually what we see.
Right.
You know, because people want the gore.
Oh, goodness. Well, we could definitely go on. But I wanted to actually pivot a bit and ask, does branding and, you know, the appropriation or co-opting of these mythological figures equate to sort of willful progressive forgetting? And I mean, I realize that's something of a rhetorical question, still worth pondering. And then the other question is, why is there a lack of curiosity when we see these logos from these brand names and companies? Why don't we go and think to ourselves, oh, I wonder where that symbol or where that depiction comes from? So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it just is the human condition, but also, you know, a personal choice. There's some people out there who are really curious, like you and I. And then there's other people who are just more right brain focused, to, you know, just get on with it. Ultimately, the construct of how we live, we don't have a lot of time, any leisure time for hobbies and deep diving, you know, certain topics. But I see what you're saying, and I think it's a shame. It's a shame. Yeah, it's like hidden in plain sight, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think even if we say, okay, let's say, well, I'm going to push back a little bit about the fact that we don't have time. Yeah, okay. But people have time to scroll. Nowadays, where you have the internet at your fingertips, people have time, somehow they make time to scroll sort of mindlessly on social media. They have time so it's a question of making time. But I think, because I think you don't have to necessarily go and do a full deep dive about any of these figures, just to get a little bit more curious about
them.
But
if you don't know, for instance, you know, you like to wear it, Nike's your favorite brand, but right, there's no clues. Like, unless you think, oh, I wonder where that name came from. If you search Nike, you don't get anything really about the goddess.
Well, you do. I mean, when
you
I
do, you, yeah, you do.
It's just a question of whether you gloss over it or not.
Yeah, I think it's a big question because everybody is different. You know, not everyone doom scrolls, not everybody, you know, but a lot of people come home from work and turn the TV on and that's it.
But I think so. I think that this is the thing, though. I think personally that there's not a lot of encouragement for being curious.
Yeah.
And if it is, it's only within a very sort of narrow spectrum or within a very narrow parameter.
Yeah.
But I do find it odd if you come across a name and go, I wonder what that is. Or just to go, I wonder where they got the symbol. And I think there is that kind of connects to this idea of things being about sort of a persistent, conditioned, maybe even a somewhat deliberate form of forgetting.
Yeah.
And it's through our education, and I certainly feel that that's there, you know, within the education systems where you're encouraged to ask certain questions.
No, you aren't.
Certain questions you're encouraged to ask, certain questions you're not. That's what I'm trying to sort of highlight. There are things that you can ask, and there are other things where it's deemed in quotations, not important, you know.
And these things aren't, you know, look, we don't even have an oral tradition anymore. It's almost like the amnesia is deliberate. They don't want us connected to our past. And I know the advent of genetics and family trees are on the rise, but, you know, ultimately, I think mythologies are for kids. Fairy tales are for kids. Curiosity is about, I mean, there's some very curious people who don't let anything slip by them. They want to know everything and they're fascinated and they do the work. I mean, you know, like you and I, we've spent our lives looking and reading at things we're interested in that we want to know more about. And not everyone is like that.
Yeah. And that's why I'm saying, that's why I think whether it's the not asking about, oh, I wonder what that logo is, you know, like, I wonder what that name is. Whether that's why it's a progressive sort of forgetting. And I think it is in some ways by design. And that's why I said there are certain questions that are encouraged and other questions that are deemed as not important, not, in other words, not encouraged. Yeah. Because like you said, mythology and fairy tales and all those things are kind of either rendered as being something for children or something that you want to do later on as an adult to explore on your own. And again, you have to be curious and you have to be drawn to that. And I think that's the problem.
Yes, and Hollywood has kind of co-opted our storytelling.
Television,
film. I mean, not that they're, you know, bad mediums. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that,
And their retelling is sometimes so devoid. So it's like it's not even 3D. It's like 2D. It's so flat. Yeah. It's so devoid of real meaning, and it's sort of cartoon sort of like figures. If you watch, I don't know, I suppose if you watch any of the Marvel or DC comic figures and you know, if you're looking at Marvel and you get, you know, you get this idea of Norse gods, Loki and Thor, and your image is the actors who portray them and their funky costumes, rather than actually trying to look up what these figures were about, these sometimes also convoluted mythological figures, you'll find that, one is actually really, really dense. And the other one is not so dense.
But luckily there are people out there who have, you know, rediscovered the Norse myths because of Marvel. But, you know, and then you just get the people who don't care.
Yes, but hopefully we can provoke people to like look at, because like I said, you know, logos and particularly with apparel, but not just. I'm thinking about right now of the Italian car Maserati, which the Maserati has the trident, the Poseidon's trident. Yeah, so if you looked at that, and next time go, oh, it's actually related to, again, Greek mythology. Yeah. So if you see, you know, you see all of these modern companies and apparel and, you know, couture brands, and we're going to get to that in just a second, co-opting the images. And it's just fascinating to me that there is that sort of, again, that it's in our collective psyche, and yet we all fall short with asking some of those questions that can really spark our curiosity. And I think we enrich the way we connect with things.
Well, look at the word logos.
Yes.
Logos, in its, I guess, its original definition, is the principle of order and knowledge, discourse, reasoning, form, and meaning of the cosmos.
Yeah.
And you know, it's an all-encompassing word, you know, that's been
reduced.
You know, kind of, yeah, absolutely reduced to a little picture.
Yes. What's your logo? And you're like, oh, well, let's unpack that, shall we? Let's unpack that. Yeah. So speaking of fashion, we went from Nike, and we're going to just do a bit of an intro, because I think, again, we could go on for hours. And I feel like we have quite a bit to quite a bit more to discuss. And I have a feeling we're going to be doing a part two, Shannon. But I think let's do a little bit of an intro to yet another very, very well-known brand, which is the fashion house Versace. And the decision of Gianni Versace to, at some point in their company's history, to use the head of the Medusa as their brand's logo.
Yeah. So has it always been the Versace logo?
No. Once upon a time, there was no logo for Gianni Versace.
Right. It
was just Gianni Versace.
Yeah.
And then it was Versace. And then I think at some point in the mid-late 1980s, the company rebranded. And it was at that point that the Versace logo included the head of the Medusa. And it's, if anyone is curious, Gianni Versace and his siblings Donatella and Santo grew up in southern Italy in Calabria. So if you look at the Italy, it looks like this big boot with Sicily, just the island off of it. And Calabria is sort of like the soul of the boot. And where he's from, in the city, I think Reggio Calabria, there's quite a number of sites of Greco-Roman villas. And in those days, there weren't quite as much protection of those sites. So he recalls playing around those places and playing over the mosaics. So he came across the iconic figure of the Medusa as a child, and it left this really strong impression on him. And then he eventually decided to incorporate it into the company's logo. And the idea was that the Medusa figure is this sort of powerful and seductive figure. You know? So on that note, maybe we can just do a little bit of an intro about the Medusa.
Sure.
Yeah. So do you want to start?
So many of you will be familiar with the figure of Medusa. She's, again, a real horrific image, character, mm-hmm. depicted throughout the centuries so many times, paintings, stories, retellings, illustrations. And interestingly enough, most of the most famous paintings of Medusa are of her severed head. And it's also interesting that I believe that, you know, Versace using Medusa as his logo, it is only the head.
Correct.
Correct. He doesn't ever show her body like a Botticelli Venus or I could be wrong. I'm not sure.
No, you're 100% right.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I was just going to say that even though he was inspired by the mosaics from the floors of these Greco-Roman villas in his hometown in southern Italy, the image that you see on the Versace brand or the Versace logo actually stems from the late 1800s, I want to say 1890s, and it's taken from a mask or a sculpture. So it wasn't actually from the tiles, it doesn't come from those Greco-Roman mosaic tiles. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I believe the Starbucks logo, the Medusa for Versace has also morphed and evolved over the years. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, when we think of Medusa, we think of this horrific, malefic, striking monster. And depending on what image you do look at, Medusa is sometimes often depicted as extremely beautiful, but mm-hmm. then she can also be quite horrific. So there's illustrations of her having tusks and a beard, and mm-hmm. And then there's her whole head is serpents, or mm-hmm. there's just a few little tiny subtle serpents. And I think also, you know, back and forth with the wings, I'm sure yeah. that there were some early mosaic illustrations of Medusa where she had little teeny wings like Hermes. on her head, on the sides of her head, almost like a crown, you know, magic crown. Now, I don't know about Medusa ever flying anywhere, but I think we're all familiar with the tale, poor Medusa. And it is, it's another tragic tale of a cursed woman. And it's very sad. So ultimately, she was sadly raped by Poseidon. Mm-hmm. So that can infer that she was very beautiful indeed. Mm-hmm. Or however you want to put it. You know how these Greek tales go. So Poseidon had his way with Medusa. This tragic incident happened within the temple of Athena.
And that's the biggest no-no.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a no-no for sure. Now, Poseidon is Athena's uncle.
Correct.
So the wrath of Athena, unfortunately, was cast upon Medusa herself. And although the victim, she could not punish her uncle.
Yes. Even though they were frequently at odds. They were rivals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which adds just another layer of complexity. Like, Athena could not stand Poseidon, like, 90% of the time.
Of course, her, you know, she didn't want Zeus's wrath to fall upon her. So she chose to punish poor Medusa instead. Hence the emergence of, you know, this tragic woman with serpentine hair and magical eyes that will, you know, upon looking into her eyes, you will be turned to stone.
Yes. Yes. And you know what's also really interesting is that the name Medusa in ancient Greek means guardian or protector. And in fact, that's what she ended up being used as in terms of, like, her iconography was used as that, because that's what the name means.
Wow. But I think the fact that she's a woman and the fact that she is so monstrous. And the human condition is that we are always fascinated with women in stories and history, because it's almost like there's this blanket of stereotyping a woman into, you know, sweet and compliant and obedient. And whereas I think this is why I was attracted to these myths, because the women were amazingly powerful. And I think there is a lot to say about Medusa in terms of the whole femme fatale phenomenon.
Yeah, and also her being actually a really tragic figure that is underdeveloped and would require us to be able to infer a little bit more. By also understanding a little bit more about the various mythologies that surround her. And it's interesting that, and again, I feel like this is really worthy of a lot more time. We could dedicate just a full episode to Medusa, but it is worth noting that in traditional stories, whether it's the Greek tracts or the later Roman tracts, particularly the Ovidian tract of the story, that the story of the Medusa is a side story in a much bigger epic tale. So we don't really get to know very much about Medusa as a woman, as a person, other than what she represented for the heroes. So in other words, the main protagonists in these epics and in these stories. And if you know a little bit about your Greek mythologies, we know about Perseus, Hercules, Jason and the Argonauts. However, no other figure except for the Medusa is as prolific in terms of iconography in the ancient world and beyond, which is, for me, really interesting because, again, I don't want to say she's a footnote in these stories, in these mythologies, but she's not a major player. And more importantly, she's really not a developed character, which for me makes it equally tragic. And so then you have these heroes or these would-be heroes and protagonists and the other divine figures, you know, you bringing up Poseidon and Athena and sort of these gods often battling it out and then using another figure often human or semi-divine or even sometimes semi-demonic, you know, powers, and then using these people as, or these individual figures as the
scapegoats.
Yes, for lack of a better word, you know. And the thing is, most people, when they think of the Medusa, what they're really probably most immediately connecting to is the figure that you can imagine from like the film like Clash of the Titans. And so that in turn was taken from the very famous Renaissance depiction of Medusa from the painter Caravaggio.
And interestingly enough, you mentioned the film, the classic film.
Yes.
Clash of the Titans. The Medusa in the film has a serpent tail.
Oh, yeah, very interesting. That's like an interesting add-on, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, it's so fascinating. This particular figure is something I mentioned earlier, could have a standalone episode, because you really, there's so many layers to peel, and so many aspects of this character and the mythology around her that we can unpack. And we haven't even got into the other mythological figures and symbols that we wanted to cover today, because we've run out of time, unfortunately. So I think we should regroup, we should reconvene and do a part two. What do you say, Shannon?
I would be delighted, Nusha. And we barely scratched the surface.
And we've only, this is like still very cursory as far as things go. But I certainly hope that it kind of encourages you to be a bit more curious next time you come across a logo and go, I wonder what that is. And just actually do that and then look it up and see what a rabbit warren of your own that you will be willing to go down into. And as Alan said, curiouser and curiouser. So thank you so much, Shannon, and thank you again also for being a volunteer for the eventual part two of this topic, and for sharing your bounty of knowledge and information and your perspective. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Happy to contribute to the food for thought.
Thank you again, Shannon.
Oh, thank you.
So, as mentioned, we've only just scratched the surface of the mythological figures, the symbols, original meanings, and stories behind some of these company logos. Hopefully, today's surface scratch will entice you to want to look into these and indeed any other companies or organizations whose logos correlate to mythologies. I've included links in the episode's description box for you to peruse through if you'd like to find out more. The questions I'd like to leave you with today, either as a conversation starter or simply as something worth pondering, is why do these mythological figures or symbols remain so prevalent today? And why do so many companies co-opt them rather than creating their own original icons for their logos? I have some ideas, and I'm sure that my guest Shannon does as well, and we'll dig into that and more in part two of this topic in the near future. So watch this space, as they say. In the meantime, free that hamster from its spinning wheel, let your mind roam freely, and, as always, Godspeed.